Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine the business world, not just as a market, but maybe like an ocean.
Right.
And for most companies, it feels like they're swimming in a sea that's already packed, you know, packed with competitors.
Yeah, totally crowded.
Everyone's chasing the same fish, the same customers. The water's choppy, maybe even, well, red.
Mm-hmm.
Our sources describe this as the red ocean, existing market spaces. Really intense competition. This relentless fight for share that often just, it devolves into price wars, slashing profits.
Yeah, it gets bloody.
And frankly, leaving everyone a bit bruised. It sounds exhausting because, well, it often is.
It really is. It's sort of the default state for so many industries, isn't it?
Seems like it.
When you focus purely on competing within those known boundaries, you're constantly reacting to rivals.
Just reacting, yeah.
You're trying to offer slightly better features or shave a tiny bit off the price, maybe outmarket the next guy. It's a real battleground mindset. And look, while that's necessary for survival in the red ocean, it rarely leads to breakthrough growth or, you know, sustained profitability. It often feels like a zero-sum game.
Right. Someone wins, someone loses, the pie stays the same size.
Hmm.
But what if you could leave that crowded, bloody water altogether?
Okay.
What if you could chart a course somewhere completely new, a vast, untapped ocean where competition is, like, minimal?
Yeah.
Or maybe non-existent.
That's the big idea.
That's the truly compelling promise at the heart of Blue Ocean strategy, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a framework that really flips the script.
How so?
Instead of just accepting market boundaries as fixed and saying, okay, how do we compete within these walls, it asks, how can we redefine those boundaries?
Ah, redefining them.
Or maybe even how can we create entirely new ones, you know, forge that uncontested space. It's all about growing the pie, fundamentally, not just fighting over the existing slices.
Growing the pie, I like that. That's precisely what we're diving deep into today.
Yeah.
We've got a fantastic stack of material from our listener, focusing specifically on this this powerful strategy developed by W. Chan Kim and Renee Mauborn.
It's really comprehensive stuff.
It really is. It gives us a great look, right, from the foundational concepts that, you know, challenge traditional thinking all the way through the practical tools you can actually use.
Like the frameworks and things.
Exactly. Mm. And some really striking real-world examples, the significant hurdles you will face, they don't shy away from that.
Which is important. It's not easy.
No, definitely not. And even how you measure success when you're creating something entirely new, which is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, the metrics have to change too. So our mission today is really to distill all this information. We're going to take you on a journey, try to understand the fundamental difference between red and blue oceans.
Okay.
Walk through the framework step by step, show you some companies who've actually done this, who've navigated to blue water successfully.
See it in action.
See it in action, but also explore the very real challenges of execution and look at how you know if you're truly sailing in a new ocean.
Think of it as a shortcut, maybe. A shortcut to understanding a strategic approach that aims to make the competition not just difficult to beat, but maybe irrelevant.
Irrelevant. That's the key word.
Okay, so let's begin by setting the scene properly, getting a crystal clear picture of this red ocean we're supposedly trying to escape. What do the sources really emphasize about its characteristics?
Well, they paint a pretty vivid picture, actually. The red ocean is the known market space. Think about industries that are really well established, you know, where the players are clear, the rules of the game are largely understood by everyone.
Right, a familiar territory.
Exactly. Companies in these markets, they primarily focus on beating their rivals. It's all about capturing existing demand.
The demand that's already there.
Yeah. And strategically, it usually boils down to differentiation or low cost. You pick one. You try to do it better or maybe cheaper than the next guy.
That classic trade-off.
It is. And the consequence of all this head-to-head competition is, well, intense pressure on prices. It just inevitably squeezes profit margins for everybody.
Makes sense.
The market space gets super crowded, which leads to that bloody competition metaphor, because the struggle for survival and dominance is just so fierce. You're fighting tooth and nail for every single customer.
Right. It sounds like a constant battle of inches, just trying to get slightly ahead And the alternative then, the blue ocean. How is that fundamentally different according to this framework?
Well, a blue ocean is pretty much the exact opposite. It's the antithesis. It represents uncontested market space.
Uncontested.
Imagine stepping out of that crowded, turbulent Red Sea and suddenly finding yourself in these calm, deep blue waters, you know, no other ships in sight, maybe.
Okay, nice image.
The core idea isn't competing for the demand that's already there. It's about creating new demand.
Ah, creating it.
Yeah. You're not trying to steal customers from your competitors. You're actually looking for non-customers, people who aren't currently buying in this space at all.
Non-customers. Interesting.
Or maybe you're defining a need that wasn't even really recognized before. You're making people realize they need something they didn't know they needed.
Creating new demand.
Yeah.
That feels like the magic trick here. It's not about just incremental improvement, making things a little bit better. It's about unlocking a whole new potential market.
That's the goal, yeah.
And by doing that, the aim is to make your existing competitors, the ones still slugging it out back in the Red Ocean,
yeah,
basically irrelevant to you.
Precisely. You're operating on a completely different plane. Your focus shifts entirely away from, you know, benchmarking rivals and trying to beat them on the usual factors.
You stop looking sideways.
Pretty much. You start setting your own standards, creating your own value curve, as they call it. The source material really emphasizes that this isn't about finding a niche within the Red Ocean, like a slightly different flavor.
Right.
It's about redefining the market boundaries themselves, often by looking across existing industry lines, seeing connections others don't.
Okay, so escaping the red, creating the blue, making competition irrelevant by creating new demand. This sounds incredibly appealing, obviously. But how do you actually bridge that gap? What's the core strategic logic that makes this shift possible? The framework seems to center on something called value innovation.
Value innovation is absolutely the core concept. It's the strategic engine, really, driving the whole Blue Ocean strategy. The sources are very clear on this. It's not simply innovation in the tech sense, and it's not merely about adding value in the traditional sense.
Okay.
Value innovation is the simultaneous pursuit of differentiation and low cost.
Right. And this is where it starts sounding a bit counterintuitive, doesn't it? Because the traditional strategy usually says you have to choose.
Generally, yeah.
You either differentiate and command a premium price, which usually means higher costs for you, or you focus on being the low-cost provider,
right,
often with less differentiation.
Yeah.
How on earth do you do both at the same time?
Yeah, that's the paradox it tackles head-on. Value innovation isn't about choosing between value and cost. It's about finding a way to break that trade-off.
Break it. How?
You fundamentally redefine what value actually means to the customer in your specific context. You dig deep to identify factors that customers truly care about, things they really value, and you elevate those significantly, maybe beyond anything the industry currently offers.
Okay, focus on what really matters.
Exactly. And maybe you even create entirely new factors, new elements of value that resonate deeply with those customers or non-customers. But crucially, at the same time, you identify and actively eliminate or reduce factors that the industry has historically competed on.
The stuff everyone does.
Yeah, the stuff everyone invests in, but which customers don't actually value that highly anymore, or perhaps which add unnecessary cost and complexity without delivering proportional value.
So you're saying provide a significant leap in value on the dimensions that matter, while simultaneously aggressively cutting costs on the dimensions that don't really matter to the customer.
That's exactly it. That's the essence of value innovation. This allows you to offer something truly unique and differentiated, justifying its value, while maintaining a cost structure that actually enables profitable growth.
Right, so you're not just slightly better.
No, you're operating on a completely different value curve. It's this unique combination, this blend of differentiation and low cost that achieves two things. It attracts customers away from the Red Ocean, and it draws in those non-customers we talked about, thereby creating that new market space.
And presumably fostering loyalty.
Absolutely. It fosters loyalty because customers are getting a kind of value they simply can't find elsewhere at a comparable cost. It makes the offering sticky.
Fascinating. It forces you to really rethink the fundamental components of your offering and your cost structure, but simultaneously, not one then the other.
Correct. It's an integrated approach.
So just summarizing these core ideas before we get into the how, it's really about creating uncontested market space, making the competition irrelevant by doing that. Shifting your strategic focus away from competing within existing boundaries to actively redefining them,
mm-hmm,
and operating with this core belief that market structure isn't just a given. It's something you can actually shape through strategic action. And the engine for that shaping is value innovation.
Those are the foundational pillars, spot on. They represent a really distinct departure from conventional competitive strategy. And importantly, to move from these concepts to actual implementation, the framework provides specific tools and methodologies. It's not just theory.
Okay, good. Which brings us nicely to the practical side. Mm-hmm. How do companies actually do this? What are the key instruments or tools the sources describe for, you know, charting a blue ocean course?
Right. It's not abstract. The framework offers concrete tools to help guide this process. The first crucial one is called the Four Actions Framework.
Four Actions Framework.
Yeah. All right.
Its purpose is really to help you systematically challenge the industry's existing strategic logic, the way things have always been done, and identify those elements of value innovation needed to reconstruct the market boundaries we talked about.
Okay, and the four actions are eliminate, reduce, raise, and create. Let's maybe take them one by one. Unpack what each means and why it's so important in breaking that value-cost trade-off based on what the material says.
Absolutely. Let's start with eliminate. This action forces you to ask, which factors that the industry takes for granted should be eliminated entirely?
Takes for granted, meaning?
These are elements that companies have always competed on, maybe invested heavily in over years, but which, if you really look closely, no longer provide significant value to customers today. Or maybe they're just assumed parts of the offering that add unnecessary cost and complexity. Think of them as industry sacred cows.
Gotcha. So stripping away the non-essentials, the things maybe everyone else is doing just out of habit or history.
Precisely that. The sources really highlight that eliminating these factors helps streamline your offering significantly. It removes complexity, it strips away unnecessary costs, and it actually sharpens your value proposition by getting rid of the noise, the clutter.
Okay.
It allows you to differentiate yourself simply by not being burdened by these outdated or low-value activities that your competitors might still cling to. That directly helps lower your operational expenses and makes that value innovation economically feasible. It forces a pretty radical rethinking of what your core offering is.
Okay, so eliminate gets rid of the dead weight, the historical baggage. What's next? Reduce.
So reduce asks a slightly different question. Which factors should be reduced well below the industry standard?
Below standard. Okay.
These are factors that customers might still expect to some degree, but maybe they don't require the level of investment or emphasis that the industry currently provides across the board. Maybe customers just don't value them enough to justify the cost or the effort competitors are putting into them.
So it's identifying areas where the industry is maybe over-serving the customer, providing more than is really needed or valued.
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head. The why here is crucial for achieving cost savings. By scaling back your investment in these specific areas, maybe offering a simpler version or less frequent service or fewer options, you achieve efficiency gains and lower your overall cost structure.
Which frees up resources.
Precisely. It frees up resources that you can then strategically redirect to the areas where you've chosen to really differentiate, the areas you want to raise or create. The sources suggest this involves scaling back on features or services that customers either don't highly value or certainly don't expect at the standard level provided by everyone else.
Got it. Cut back on the less important stuff to save resources. Then comes raise. This sounds like the opposite.
It is. The raise action is about identifying which factors should be raised well above the industry standard.
Above standard now.
Yes. These are the dimensions where you identify real opportunities to offer a truly superior experience or performance, something that customers value significantly and maybe aren't getting currently. It requires a really deep understanding of what delights customers or addresses their unmet needs the current industry might be failing to serve adequately.
So this is about amplifying the factors that truly matter to the customer, the areas where you really want to stand out and be different.
Yes, exactly. By raising these specific elements, you dramatically enhance your value proposition. You create distinctive features that really differentiate your offering in a meaningful way. This is key to attracting customers and, importantly, fostering that loyalty we mentioned.
Makes sense.
The sources do point out, though, that this requires a really thorough understanding of customer preferences. You have to know what they truly value and might even be willing to pay a premium for if it were offered in a compelling way. It's not just raising things arbitrarily.
Right. Strategic raising. And finally, the fourth action, create. This sounds like where the real novelty comes in.
It often is. This is where you introduce completely new factors, things that the industry has never offered before.
Entirely new stuff.
Yeah. Create involves developing entirely new sources of value, things that open up new dimensions of appeal, maybe targeting those non-customers or serving existing customers in ways previously unimagined within that industry. It's not just adding another.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Feature to the list.
It's more fundamental.
It can be. It might involve developing novel business models or leveraging cutting-edge technology in completely new ways or fundamentally rethinking the entire customer experience from the ground up.
By creating a whole new service or maybe even a product category that didn't really exist before within that context.
Precisely. By creating these novel factors, companies effectively break away from the existing competitive space. They set new standards. They redefine what constitutes value in this evolving market, and they essentially forge completely new market territories, the blue ocean itself.
That's where the blue ocean really emerges.
Exactly. The sources emphasize that this is where true innovation, the kind that leads to generating genuinely new demand, often happens.
Okay, so the four actions framework, eliminate, reduce, raise, it's like a systematic way to dissect your industry.
Mm-hmm.
Not just looking at what competitors do, but digging into what customers truly value, where the costs really lie, and then figuring out how you can reconstruct the offering by strategically deciding what to stop doing, what to do less of, what to do much more of, and what to do that's entirely new.
Yeah, it's like deconstructing the existing industry's DNA and then reassembling it in a completely different, more valuable way.
That's a great analogy. And to make this deconstruction and reconstruction visible and actionable, the framework uses another key analytical tool you mentioned, the strategy canvas.
Yes, the strategy canvas. It's vital.
So the strategy canvas, how does this tool fit in? How does it help with applying those four actions?
The strategy canvas is essentially a diagnostic tool and a visual representation of the current competitive landscape.
A visual map.
Pretty much. On the horizontal axis, you list the key factors that the industry traditionally competes on, invests in things like price, specific features, customer service level, marketing spend, maybe distribution channels, things like that.
Okay, the usual suspects.
Right. Then on the vertical axis, you plot the offering level from low to high that various competitors, including yourself, provide across each of these factors. When you connect the dots for each competitor, you create what's called a value curve.
The value curve.
Oh.
So you can literally see how different companies are positioned relative to each other. Maybe see if they're all kind of clustered together, offering similar things at similar levels.
Exactly. That's one of its main powers. It immediately reveals the current state of play, the shape of competition. It shows you very clearly where competitors are investing their resources and where they're focusing their efforts. You often see value curves that look remarkably similar, indicating a red ocean where everyone's trying to beat each other on the same terms.
Right. Mimicking each other.
Yeah. The real power of the strategy canvas, though, lies in the clarity it provides for identifying blue ocean opportunities. By visualizing the industry's current value curve, it helps you pinpoint those factors that are ripe for elimination or reduction, maybe factors where everyone invests heavily, but the returns in terms of customer value are diminishing, or they just add cost without differentiation.
You see the areas of potential cuts.
Correct. And just as importantly, it helps you see the gaps. It reveals areas where you could potentially raise the standard way above what anyone else is doing, or even create entirely new factors that aren't currently on the industry's radar at all.
So you can draw a new curve.
Precisely. The goal is to use the insights from the canvas to draw a value curve for your planned offering that looks fundamentally different from the rest of the industry, a curve that diverges, that charts a clear path into the blue ocean.
Okay, so if I'm understanding this right, the strategy canvas is like the map. It shows you where the red ocean currently is, where everyone's sailing, and it helps you spot where potential blue water might lie.
Yeah. That's a good way to think of it.
And the four actions framework, eliminate, reduce, raise, create, that's like the set of instructions or the design principles for building the ship and plotting the course to actually get to that blue water.
That's a very apt analogy. The sources make it really clear that applying the four actions framework in conjunction with analyzing and then intentionally redrawing the strategy canvas is what enables the identification and, crucially, the execution of value innovation.
They work together.
They absolutely work together. That combination is what unlocks new demand and allows companies to seize growth in those uncontested spaces. You use the canvas to see the current reality and identify the elements you need to change, and the four actions are the levers you pull to actually create your new reality, your new divergent value curve on that canvas.
Theory and tools are great, and that makes sense. But seeing this stuff in action really brings it to life, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Examples make it concrete.
And our sources provide some really powerful examples of companies that have apparently successfully navigated to blue oceans across all sorts of different industries. Let's maybe walk through a few of those and try to show how they actually applied these principles or actions we've just discussed.
Sounds good. Let's start with healthcare. The rise of telemedicine platforms is a really compelling example, I think.
Okay. Telemedicine.
Think about the traditional red ocean here. Physical clinics, hospitals, appointments that require travel, often long waits in waiting rooms.
Yeah, the standard experience for many.
Right. And telemedicine fundamentally changed that dynamic. By leveraging technology, companies like those referenced in the sources, they essentially eliminated the need for physical travel for many types of consultations.
Big elimination.
Huge. And they reduced the strain on physical facilities, reduced wait times significantly in many cases, but simultaneously, they raised convenience massively care from home. And they created entirely new access points for care. Well, especially for people in remote areas or underserved populations, or even just for common, simple issues that don't strictly require a hands-on physical exam, they made healthcare accessible in a new way.
Okay, that fits the pattern perfectly. Lowering costs, less need for physical infrastructure, maybe more efficient use of clinician time while raising value through convenience and access.
Exactly. That's value innovation in action. The sources note that this model achieved really rapid growth and effectively set a new standard for certain types of medical interactions. It tapped into a huge pool of demand from people who found traditional healthcare inconvenient, maybe too time-consuming or inaccessible for minor issues. It created this hybrid space that just didn't really exist before.
Makes sense. How about e-commerce? That feels like such a massively crowded red ocean right now.
Oh, it absolutely is. Fiercely competitive. But even there, companies can find blue pockets, or at least bluer water. Our sources point to players like, let's call them Company B, who managed to differentiate not just on price or the sheer volume of goods they offered.
Which is where a lot of the competition happens.
Right. Instead, they focused on sophisticated AI-driven personalization. So while many competitors were offering pretty generic recommendations or basic filtering tools, this company eliminated that often frustrating experience of wading through tons of irrelevant products.
Okay, got rid of the noise.
Exactly. And they created a highly curated, deeply personalized shopping experience, often using something like an AI assistant or incredibly smart algorithms that learned your preferences.
So they effectively raised the intelligence and the helpfulness of the whole shopping interaction.
Yeah.
Made it feel less like browsing a huge catalog and more like having a personal shopper.
Precisely. This intense focus on deep personalization significantly enhanced user engagement, it boosted conversion rates, and it fostered real customer loyalty because the shopping process felt intuitive, tailored, almost effortless. They weren't just selling products, they were selling a superior, personalized shopping journey. And by doing that, they effectively created a niche based on the quality of that interaction, something that wasn't the primary competitive factor for most other e-commerce players at the time.
So that's like creating a blue experience within what's otherwise a very red market. Mm-hmm. Interesting. What about sustainable energy?
Yeah, the sources highlight models like solar panel leasing, which was pioneered by companies like the referenced Company C.
Right.
Traditionally, if you wanted to adopt solar energy for your home, it required a massive upfront investment.
Right. It's a barrier for most people.
Absolutely, a huge barrier. So what did the leasing model do? Well, they effectively eliminated that prohibitive upfront cost barrier. That was the killer move.
Took the biggest obstacle off the table.
Exactly. And they created a new way to access essentially a subscription-like model where customers paid a lower, manageable monthly fee, often less than their old energy bill. This allowed them to benefit from clean energy immediately without that huge financial strain.
Make solar accessible.
Completely redefined access. It tapped into a much, much broader base of environmentally conscious consumers who simply couldn't afford the traditional purchase model. They effectively changed the market from selling a high-cost product, the panels, to selling a service and a benefit affordable clean energy over time.
Brilliant. Okay, entertainment is another industry that's seen absolutely massive blue ocean shifts. Netflix is probably the classic example everyone thinks of.
Oh, absolutely. Textbook example. Before Netflix streaming really took off, the red ocean was dominated by physical video rental stores like Blockbuster.
Right. Remember those?
Vividly. Competition back then was all about store locations, how big your inventory was, and infamously, late fees.
Ugh, late fees.
Exactly. Netflix initially competed somewhat differently with their mail order DVDs, which already reduced some friction, but their true blue ocean move was streaming. They eliminated late fees entirely. They eliminated the need to travel to a physical store.
Convenience factor way up.
Way up. And they raised the sheer volume of content available instantly. Then, crucially, they created entirely new value through on-demand access from home, personalized recommendations, and eventually their own original programming.
So they completely shifted the value proposition away from physical access and timely returns towards convenience, volume, and unique content.
Exactly. It totally changed consumption patterns, didn't it? And it made Blockbuster's massive physical infrastructure and their whole business model increasingly irrelevant over time. Netflix wasn't competing on the same terms anymore. They created a whole new way to consume entertainment.
Right.
And they attracted not just existing video renters, but also loads of non-customers who were probably put off by the hassle and cost of the old model.
And Nintendo Wii in the gaming world feels like a similar kind of story, right? Disrupting the norms.
Very similar logic, yeah. The gaming industry red ocean, especially back then, was largely defined by this arms race competing on increasingly powerful graphics processors, more complex gameplay, all aimed primarily at a core demographic of, you know, serious or hardcore gamers.
Yeah, the specs war.
Totally. Nintendo Wii looked completely beyond that core group. What do? They reduced the emphasis on cutting-edge, high-definition graphics compared to their rivals like PlayStation and Xbox. They eliminated the barrier of complex multi-button controller schemes for many of their key games.
Made it simpler.
Much simpler. And then they created this intuitive motion-sensing gameplay that was easy to pick up and appealed to a vastly wider audience, families, seniors, casual players, people who'd maybe never even considered playing video games before.
They essentially redefined who a gamer could be and what gaming even meant for a lot of people.
Precisely. They didn't try to compete head-to-head on polygon counts or frame rates. They created a blue ocean based on accessibility, social interaction, fun physical activity. Yeah. The sources highlight how this move just completely revitalized Nintendo and captured a massive market leadership position by expanding the entire gaming market, bringing in millions of non-customers.
Incredible. Financial services seems like another area ripe for this, especially with the rise of fintech.
Oh, definitely. The traditional banking red ocean involved, you know, fiscal branches, often complex and opaque fee structures, sometimes slower processes for loans or transfers.
Like old way.
Yeah. Fintech companies have burst onto the scene challenging all of this. They've eliminated the reliance on physical locations for many, many routine transactions. They've often reduced fees significantly through more efficient digital processes and lower overheads.
Mm-hmm.
And they've created things like incredibly user-friendly mobile apps, almost instantaneous payment systems, think peer-to-peer lending or payment platforms, and easily accessible digital wallets.
So again, it's raising convenience, raising speed, while lowering cost and complexity for the user.
Fundamentally, yes. They've completely reshaped how many people engage with financial services, making them more accessible, often less intimidating, especially for younger generations or those underserved by traditional banks. They tapped into customers who found traditional banking inconvenient, expensive, or just annoying, created new channels, new models.
Yeah. And the education example you mentioned, Company D using the strategy canvas, how did that play out?
Right. This example shows the tools being put into practice. So Company D was operating in the online education red ocean, a space that's gotten very crowded, right? Competing mainly on the breadth of course, catalogs, maybe instructor credentials.
Lots of players there.
Exactly. By using the strategy canvas, they visualized the competitive landscape. They saw that while most competitors focused heavily on just adding more courses, more static content factors, they realized they could potentially reduce or eliminate emphasis on there was a big opportunity.
An opportunity where?
An opportunity to significantly raise student engagement and to create truly interactive learning experiences. So based on that insight from the canvas, they developed a platform that wasn't just about delivering video lectures or PDFs. It was about facilitating dynamic learning through things like simulations, collaborative projects, instant personalized feedback loops.
Making learning more active.
Exactly, making it more active, more engaging. And by doing that, they differentiated themselves significantly in a crowded space. They created a more effective and appealing learning environment, attracting students looking for more than just passive content consumption.
These examples are really powerful because they underline that Blue Ocean strategy isn't just about making minor tweaks around the edges.
No, it's fundamental.
It's about fundamentally changing the value proposition and the cost structure by redefining the competitive factors themselves. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Indigo Airlines focusing relentlessly on being timely and low cost in a notoriously difficult airline market.
Yep, broke the trade-off there.
Cirque du Soleil. They eliminated animals and star performers, which were huge cost drivers in traditional circuses.
Right.
And they created this whole new form of entertainment, artistry, music, narrative, appealing to theater goers and traditional circus fans, a whole new audience.
Completely new category.
And Yellowtail Wine. Right. They eliminated all the complex jargon and intimidating aspects of traditional wine labels and marketing.
Made it simple. Made it simple, approachable. And they rebuild. Created a brand that appealed to casual drinkers, maybe people who usually drink beer or spirits, who found the traditional wine world off-putting, again, tapping non-customers.
They all really illustrate that core principle. Don't just try to compete where everyone else is already fighting. Create your own space by offering value in a fundamentally new, often simpler, more focused way.
That's the essence of it. However, and this is a big however, identifying a potential blue ocean is one thing. Actually executing the strategy to get there and thrive is another challenge entirely. It's far, far from easy.
Yeah, that feels like a massive understatement. Shifting an entire organization, especially a successful one, to pursue a strategy that's so different from what made it successful, that must be incredibly difficult. The sources highlight four key hurdles to execution, don't they? Specific obstacles.
They do. They call them the four primary hurdles of execution, and they stress that overcoming these is absolutely critical for any chance of success. First, there's the cognitive hurdle.
Cognitive hurdle, meaning?
This is all about getting the organization, the people inside it, to even recognize the need for a strategic shift in the first place. People inside a company, especially one that's doing reasonably well, can be kind of blind to the red ocean they're swimming in. Or maybe they accept it as just the way things are.
Complacency.
Yeah, or just deeply ingrained assumptions. They're focused on beating the known competitors within the existing paradigm. Getting them to see the possibility, let alone the necessity, of pursuing a blue ocean requires challenging those really deep-seated mindsets and assumptions about their industry and their business.
So step one is just opening people's eyes to the problem and the potential alternative solution.
Exactly. Making the case for change compellingly. Then hurdle number two is the resource hurdle.
Resources. Okay. Money, people.
Money, people, time, assets. Yeah. Implementing a blue ocean strategy almost always requires redirecting resources, funding, top talent, management attention away from established, maybe profitable activities and towards new, often unproven initiatives.
Taking resources away from the cash cows.
Potentially, yes. And that can be incredibly difficult, especially when resources are already perceived as scarce, budgets are tight, and there's natural resistance to funding something that seems risky or doesn't fit the traditional investment criteria or business unit structure. You might genuinely feel like you don't have the resources for such a radical shift, even if the idea is good.
So even if you see the blue ocean, you might feel like you don't have the ship or the crew or the fuel to actually get there.
That's a very real challenge for many companies. The third hurdle is the motivational hurdle.
Motivation.
Keeping people going. Exactly. It's about getting people not just to understand the strategy intellectually, that's the cognitive part, and having the resources allocated, the resource part, but actually feeling motivated and deeply committed to executing it effectively.
The want to.
The want to. Change is hard. We all know that. Building a blue ocean often involves significant effort, a lot of uncertainty, ambiguity, and personal or professional risk for those involved. Keeping morale high, inspiring the workforce to persevere through inevitable setbacks and challenges, that's vital. It's about winning hearts and minds, not just getting grudging compliance.
Yeah, that sounds crucial but tough.
Yeah.
And the fourth one, the political hurdle. That sounds like internal power dynamics and turf wars.
It absolutely is. That's exactly what it refers to. Any significant strategic change, especially one as potentially disruptive as pursuing a blue ocean, can threaten established power bases, departmental silos, and longstanding political alignments within an organization.
People protecting their turf.
Definitely. Individuals or entire departments who benefit from the status quo, who hold power or prestige in the current red ocean way of doing things, may actively or sometimes passively resist the shift. Navigating these internal politics, building coalitions of support, and neutralizing opposition from powerful stakeholders is a major, major challenge for leaders driving this kind of change.
How do you deal with that?
Well, the sources suggest that adopting practices they call fair process is crucial here.
Fair process.
Yeah, it means ensuring people feel involved or at least consulted
in
engagement, clearly explaining the rationale behind decisions, even unpopular ones. Explanation, and setting very clear expectations about the new rules of the game, how performance will be judged, and what the consequences are. Clarity.
So transparency and involvement.
Basically, yes. When people feel they've been treated fairly in the process, even if they don't initially agree with the outcome, it builds trust and fosters commitment. It makes those hurdles cognitive, resource, motivational, and political much easier to clear.
Okay, fair process sounds like a really key element in overcoming those potentially show-stopping internal barriers. Now, beyond just clearing those initial hurdles, the sources also seem to emphasize that for a blue ocean strategy to be not just launched, but successful and sustainable over time, it needs real alignment across the entire organization. It can't just be a skunkworks project.
This is absolutely crucial. You're right. The framework identifies three critical propositions that must be tightly aligned for long-term success. They are the value proposition, the profit proposition, and the people proposition.
Value, profit, people.
If any one of these is out of sync with the others, the strategy is likely to stumble or fail, especially in the long run.
Can you tell us a bit more about that alignment? What does each proposition mean here?
Sure. The value proposition first must be truly compelling to customers. It needs to offer that significant leap in value we discussed earlier, that unique combination of differentiation and utility that really attracts your target customers, and especially those non-customers you're trying to bring into the market.
Makes sense.
If your value proposition isn't clear, or if it doesn't genuinely resonate with what buyers or potential buyers care about, they simply won't be drawn to your blue ocean, no matter how clever the strategy seems on paper.
So, rule one.
Mm-hmm.
You've actually got to offer something people genuinely find worthwhile.
Exactly. Can't skip that step. Second is the profit proposition. This means your underlying business model must be economically viable in this new space you're creating.
Not make money.
You have to be able to translate the value you're offering into profitable revenue sustainably. This involves having a very clear understanding of your cost structure, linked back to eliminate and reduce actions, your pricing strategy, which might be different in a blue ocean, and your sales and delivery model to ensure that the value you create also generates healthy, sustainable profits for the company.
Because you can offer incredible value, but if it costs you more to deliver than you actually make from it,
you won't be around for long. Exactly.
Yeah.
So the business model has to work. And third is the people proposition.
People. The internal side again.
Yes. This focuses on the internal aspect, your employees, and maybe even key partners. The people proposition ensures that the organization is motivated, capable, and aligned to execute the strategy effectively and efficiently day in, day out.
So having the right team and keeping them motivated.
It's about having the right culture, the right skills, the right incentives, the right processes in place so that your workforce is not just willing, but enthusiastic and fully equipped to actually deliver on the unique value proposition and the necessary profit proposition. If your people aren't on board, or if they aren't capable of delivering that unique value efficiently, the whole strategy inevitably falls apart during execution.
Okay, so it's like a three-legged stool. Success requires that your unique value offering strongly attracts customers. Value. That you can actually make money doing it. Profit. And that your team, your people, are properly set up and motivated to deliver it consistently. People. All three legs have to be strong and work together.
Precisely. The sources really stress that achieving this tight alignment across all three propositions is absolutely vital for building and, crucially, maintaining a sustainable advantage in the new market space. It's not enough to just have a brilliant idea for a blue ocean. The entire organizational system needs to be geared up to support it.
Okay, so let's assume a company has done all this hard work. They've identified a potential blue ocean. They've navigated the internal hurdles. They've aligned the value, profit, and people propositions, and they've launched the new offering. How do they actually know if it's working? Standard metrics, like market share in the old red ocean, might not really capture the success of creating something entirely new, right? How do you measure a blue ocean strategy effectively?
That's a really critical question, and you're right. Traditional metrics often fall short. You need metrics that reflect the unique nature and goals of blue ocean strategy. The sources highlight several key areas for key performance indicators, KPIs, that go beyond just looking at traditional market share battles or incremental improvements.
Okay, let's dive into those KPIs. Financial metrics are still involved, I assume, but maybe with a twist?
Yes, absolutely. Financial metrics remain crucial. Things like revenue growth, profit margins, return on investment are still fundamental. But the key distinction in a blue ocean context is the comparison point.
Comparison to what?
You shouldn't just compare your financial performance to the average competitor back in the old red ocean industry you disrupted or moved away from. A truly successful blue ocean strategy should demonstrate financial performance that significantly outperforms those traditional industry standards or benchmarks.
A big gap.
Exactly. It's the gap in performance, significantly higher growth rates, much better margins, that indicates you're not just doing slightly better within the old market rules, but are actually benefiting from the unique dynamics of creating and capturing new value in a less contested or even uncontested space. That superior financial performance is a key signal of blue ocean success.
Okay, so it's about demonstrating that you've moved on to a much more profitable playing field. What about measuring the creation of the blue ocean itself? There was mention of a market creation rate.
Yes, this is a core blue ocean metric really specific to the strategy. It tracks how effectively you are generating and capturing genuinely new demand and expanding the overall market size.
How do you track that?
You monitor the rate at which new customers are entering the market specifically for your offering. And you pay particular attention to tracking non-customers, those individuals or groups who weren't buyers in the related red ocean before you came along.
Bringing new people in?
Exactly. You also track the growth rate of the total market size that you've effectively created or redefined. The sources emphasize that a healthy, thriving blue ocean strategy will show both a rapid increase in new customer acquisition, especially from non-customer groups, and a significant expansion of the overall market size. This proves you are truly expanding demand, not just shuffling existing customers around.
That makes perfect sense. You're literally measuring the creation and growth of the market itself. What about the imitation lag time? That sounds intriguing.
This metric is all about the sustainability of your blue ocean advantage. It measures how long it takes for competitors to wake up, recognize your success in the blue ocean, and begin to effectively imitate your strategy or key aspects of your offering.
How long you have the blue water to yourself?
Essentially, yes. Obviously, a longer imitation lag time is highly desirable. It gives you more time to operate in that relatively uncontested space, build customer loyalty, achieve economies of scale, and further strengthen your position before serious competition arrives.
How would you track that?
You could track things like the time elapsed until the first direct competitor launches a recognizably similar offering, or perhaps the time until you start seeing significant shifts in market share towards these new imitators.
So it's really a measure of how durable your blue ocean is before the red inevitably starts to creep back in around the edges.
Exactly. And the goal isn't necessarily to prevent imitation forever. That's usually impossible. It's more about creating significant barriers to easy or quick imitation through ongoing innovation, building a strong brand reputation, creating network effects if possible, or securing unique partnerships, things that make it difficult, costly, and time-consuming for others to copy you successfully. Then, related to this, are sustainability metrics, which look more broadly at the long-term health of your innovation efforts.
Okay, sustainability.
Yeah.
How do those work? What do they measure?
These metrics evaluate your ability to maintain momentum and stay ahead, potentially even creating the next blue ocean. This involves tracking the health of your internal innovation pipeline. Things like the number and quality of new ideas or initiatives currently in development that could lead to future blue oceans or significantly reinforce your current competitive advantage.
Looking ahead?
Yes. It also involves closely monitoring things like brand loyalty and customer retention rates within your created market. High loyalty and retention are strong indicators that your unique value proposition continues to resonate deeply with customers and that you're successfully defending your position even as the market space potentially evolves or attracts some competitive attention.
It really sounds like launching a blue ocean isn't a one-time event then. You almost have to keep innovating just to stay blue or at least keep the competition at bay.
Precisely. Complacency is the enemy. You need to be prepared to evolve, adapt, and potentially even disrupt yourself before others do. And finally, the sources also highlight employee and partner engagement as vital internal metrics.
Right, internal metrics again. Why are these so important for measuring what seems like an external market strategy like Blue Ocean?
Because, as we discussed with the people proposition, successful execution relies so heavily on internal alignment, capability, and motivation. Metrics like employee satisfaction scores, employee engagement levels, maybe even tracking satisfaction among key partners and suppliers. These provide crucial insights into whether the organization is actually functioning effectively to deliver that unique value proposition consistently and efficiently.
Healthy inside, strong outside.
Kind of, yeah. High engagement suggests your workforce is committed, capable, and pulling in the same direction, which is absolutely essential for both the initial launch and the sustained success required to deliver unique value efficiently in that new, potentially challenging market space.
Okay, so putting it all together, measuring Blue Ocean success requires a broader perspective, looking beyond just traditional sales figures and market share within the old boundaries.
Definitely.
And focusing instead on things like significant financial outperformance compared to the old industry, the actual creation and growth rate of new markets and non-customer acquisition, the duration of your competitive advantage against imitation, your ongoing innovation capacity, and the health of your internal alignment and engagement.
That gives you a much more comprehensive, multifaceted picture of whether you've truly achieved and are successfully maintaining a blue ocean state. And as the sources constantly reiterate, successfully implementing the strategy and effectively measuring it requires continually addressing those cognitive, resource, motivational, and political hurdles we discussed earlier through really robust communication, training, leadership, and that fair process concept.
We've mapped out the vision, the tools, the examples, the execution path, the measurement. But, you know, like any powerful strategy, Blue Ocean strategy isn't presented as a flawless solution. It's not without its own set of challenges and critiques. It's certainly not a guaranteed path to success.
That's absolutely true, and it's important to acknowledge. The sources are quite realistic about the inherent difficulties and criticisms. One of the primary critiques that often comes up is the practicality of finding blue oceans in the first place.
Is it really possible?
Well, some critics argue that identifying truly uncontested market spaces is becoming increasingly difficult, maybe especially in mature or highly saturated industries. The question is it always possible to just create a blue ocean through clever strategy? Or are these opportunities actually quite rare, maybe limited to certain types of industries, or reliant on major technological breakthroughs?
Yeah, it can feel daunting, can't it? To look at a really crowded market and believe you can just conjure up a completely empty space next to it.
It definitely can feel that way. Another critique that's often raised is about potential trade-offs surfacing over time. While the framework brilliantly emphasizes the simultaneous pursuit of differentiation and low cost.
The core value innovation idea.
Right. Critics question whether this is always truly sustainable in the long run without compromise. Does the relentless pressure to maintain a low-cost structure eventually, inevitably, lead to compromises in quality or service levels or ongoing innovation, potentially harming the brand's unique value proposition over time? There's a real tension there that needs constant, careful management.
It sounds like you're trying to do two fundamentally difficult things at once. There's always a risk of not quite doing either perfectly or letting one slide to achieve the other.
Exactly. It's a delicate balancing act. And then there's the significant imitation risk we touched upon briefly when discussing the KPIs. This is a major practical challenge.
Some jitters catching on.
Yes. Even if you successfully create a blue ocean and enjoy initial success, that very success will inevitably attract attention. Competitors, seeing your profitability and market growth, will eventually attempt to enter your newly created space or copy key aspects of your strategy or offering.
It's inevitable, really.
Pretty much. The sources highlight that while you might enjoy a valuable lag time, imitation is a very real and constant threat that ultimately undermines the longevity of that purely uncontested space. Sustaining the blue ocean edge against determined followers is a major ongoing challenge.
So the very success you achieve paradoxically makes you a target and starts to potentially turn your blue ocean reddish over time.
That's the dynamic, yes. And beyond these critiques of the core concept itself, there are all those real-world implementation challenges we've hinted at throughout our conversation.
Right, the practical difficulties of actually doing it.
Yes. We talked about organizational inertia and resistance, that deeply ingrained difficulty of shifting established mindsets and overcoming the magnetic pull of the status quo, especially in large or successful organizations. This isn't just about managers understanding a new idea on a PowerPoint slide. It's about changing embedded routines, behaviors, and core beliefs across the company.
It really requires a significant culture change, doesn't it? Not just a new strategy document.
Precisely, a huge lift. Another major practical challenge is the market insights difficulty. We mentioned this, identifying those opportunities for value innovation requires incredibly deep insights, not just into your existing customers, but crucially, into NAN customers.
Understanding people who aren't buying.
Exactly. Understanding why non-customers aren't currently participating in the market and figuring out what combination of value and cost would compel them to enter a new market space. That requires really innovative, often resource-intensive, and time-consuming research approaches. It's much, much harder than just analyzing your existing competitors and surveying your current customer base.
Because you're effectively trying to understand and even predict a market that doesn't actually exist yet in its final form.
Fundamentally, yes. You're shaping demand, not just responding to it. And that core challenge of balancing differentiation and cost isn't just a conceptual critique, it's a very real practical execution difficulty.
Getting it right in practice.
Yeah, companies run the risk of over-innovating, creating something new and highly differentiated, but maybe making it too complex or too expensive for the target non-customer segment they were hoping to attract. Or, conversely, they might cut costs too aggressively in the wrong places, undermining the unique value proposition they were trying to create in the first place. Striking that precise, optimal balance in execution is notoriously difficult.
It really sounds like walking a strategic tightrope.
It often is, requiring constant adjustment and learning. Then there's also the challenge of market understanding and acceptance. Let's say you manage to build a beautiful blue ocean offering, perfectly balanced, but will the market truly understand its value? Will they accept it?
Will they get it?
Exactly. Misjudging latent needs, failing to effectively educate the market about the benefits of your novel offering, or perhaps hitting the market before it's truly ready for that kind of change. These can lead to failure, even if the strategy itself was conceptually sound and well executed internally.
So building it doesn't automatically guarantee they will come or understand why they should.
A painful but common truth in radical innovation. And we shouldn't forget regulatory and legal hurdles. These can pop up unexpectedly.
Oh, so.
When you create an entirely new market space or a radically different business model, existing regulations might not neatly apply. Or worse, new regulations might be created specifically to address your innovation, perhaps lobbied for by incumbents. This can lead to unforeseen legal battles, significant compliance costs, and frustrating delays, adding a whole layer of complexity and expense you didn't anticipate.
So you might be sailing in clear market waters, but suddenly find the legal or regulatory charts haven't been drawn yet, or are being drawn specifically to block you.
That's a good way to think about it. Uncharted territory in multiple senses. And finally, even wildly successful blue oceans face significant scalability and growth management challenges.
Growing pains.
Big time. Growing rapidly in a brand new market space where the dynamics aren't fully understood yet, scaling operations efficiently while maintaining quality, building the right infrastructure, hiring and training rapidly, and simultaneously defending against emerging competition as the space inevitably becomes better known. These can be incredibly difficult management challenges. They often require very different skills and processes than simply operating efficiently in a mature, stable red ocean.
Wow. Okay, so identifying, launching, executing, and sustaining a blue ocean strategy are all fraught with potential pitfalls at every stage. It clearly requires immense strategic rigor, organizational capability, resilience, and probably a bit of luck, too.
It absolutely demands resilience, adaptability, strong leadership, and a real willingness to navigate high levels of uncertainty. It's not for the faint of heart.
Let's bring it back then, maybe circle back to the fundamental distinction we started with. After exploring the strategy, the tools, the examples, the execution, the measurement, and all these challenges, the core difference between red ocean and blue ocean strategy becomes even sharper, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The contrast is stark, and it really defines two fundamentally different strategic approaches. Red ocean, again, is defined by competing head-to-head in existing known market space.
The crowded battlefield.
Right. Fighting fiercely for market share, which typically leads down the path of intense price competition, inevitably diminishing profits, and this constant zero-sum rivalry over existing finite demand.
And Blue Ocean, conversely, is all about creating that uncontested market space, making the existing competition irrelevant not by beating them, but by sidestepping them, and unlocking entirely new demand, growing the overall pie.
Exactly. The key differences, just to really hammer them home as emphasized in the sources, it's about focus. Red Ocean focuses intensely on beating rivals in the existing space. Blue Ocean focuses on innovation to create new market space and tap into new demand pools.
Compete versus create.
Precisely. It's about demand. Red Ocean competes for existing known demand. Blue Ocean actively works to create and capture new demand, often from non-customers.
Capture versus create demand.
Good summary. It's about the value-cost relationship. Red Ocean generally accepts the trade-off you choose, either differentiation, usually higher cost, or low cost, usually less differentiation. Blue Ocean actively pursues the simultaneous achievement of both differentiation and low cost through that mechanism of value innovation.
Break the trade-off.
Break the trade-off.
And finally, it's about systematic alignment. Red Ocean strategies typically align the entire organizational system, activities, structure, culture around supporting either the differentiation or the low-cost position. Blue Ocean strategies require aligning the entire system to be able to effectively pursue and deliver both differentiation and low-cost simultaneously. It's a more complex alignment challenge.
Right. And we saw these principles clearly embodied in those examples. Indigo Airlines in India, redefining budget air travel by focusing relentlessly on being timely and low-cost, addressing two major pain points simultaneously.
Yeah, a great case.
Cirque du Soleil, creating a whole new category of entertainment by blending elements of circus with theater, art, and music, eliminating high-cost traditional elements and raising artistic value, appealing to an entirely new, often adult, audience base.
Completely different offer.
And Yellowtail Wine, making wine accessible and fun by stripping away the complexity and intimidation, simplifying the product choices and marketing, reaching millions of casual drinkers who were previously outside the traditional wine market. They didn't just compete better, they fundamentally altered the landscape by creating new value propositions and cost structures.
They absolutely did. These examples really reinforced that the framework, while undoubtedly challenging to implement successfully, offers a genuinely powerful and potentially highly rewarding alternative to the conventional wisdom of just engaging in head-to-head competition within established boundaries.
So, wrapping things up, we've navigated the core concepts of Blue Ocean strategy. We've explored the practical tools like the Four Actions Framework and the Strategy Canvas. We've seen how it's been applied sometimes spectacularly across diverse industries. We've discussed the critical steps for execution and measurement. And importantly, we've faced the significant challenges and critiques head on.
It's been a comprehensive dive. The potential prize is really clear. The chance to escape that crowded, often brutal Red Ocean competition, unlock potentially massive new growth by creating new demand, and establish a period of sustainable competitive advantage in relatively uncontested space. It's a truly powerful strategic lens to adopt.
But it's equally clear, as we've discussed, that it is absolutely not a magic bullet or a simple formula.
Far from it.
It demands deep market insight, particularly into non-customers. It requires genuine, often risky innovation. It takes considerable courage and skill to overcome those internal organizational hurdles, and it needs incredibly careful, aligned execution across value, profit, and people. It really requires a fundamentally different way of thinking about strategy, about competition, and about value itself.
It really asks companies and their leaders to be pioneers, to be explorers charting new waters, not just efficient operators refining existing routes.
And for you, listening, whether you're an entrepreneur, maybe looking for your next big idea, or a leader within an established company trying to find new avenues for growth and revitalize the business, or maybe just someone curious about strategic thinking and how markets evolve, understanding Blue Ocean strategy gives you, I think, a powerful new way to look at the world. Not just asking, how do I compete better in the current game?
Right.
But asking the more fundamental, potentially more rewarding question. How can I create a new game altogether, a space where I don't necessarily have to compete head-to-head at all?
It fundamentally changes the question from how to outperform rivals to how to make rivals irrelevant by creating a new race, a new market space.
Okay, so as we wrap up this deep dive, let's leave you with that final provocative thought. Drawing again from the sources, something for you to maybe mull over.
Mm-hmm.
The material consistently discusses the challenge of imitation, how success in a blue ocean inevitably attracts followers, competitors who eventually swim into your waters, potentially turning those blue waters reddish again over time.
The sustainability challenge.
Exactly. So if the core goal of the strategy is to create uncontested market space, but achieving success in that space inherently makes it contested eventually, does a true sustainable blue ocean strategy actually require a continuous process of reinvention? Does it mean constantly seeking and moving to new blue oceans as your previous ones inevitably get more crowded?
Where's the goal different?
Or perhaps is the strategic objective simply to maximize the benefits and the duration of that initial invitation lag time? Enjoy the uncontested space for as long as possible, build advantages, and extract maximum value before the competition inevitably catches up. It really raises fundamental questions about the nature of sustained competitive advantage in a world that's constantly changing. Something to think about as you look at the markets around you.